Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader Candy Lewis, along with her co-host, Bullet Lewis. We begin our program with a couple of daily selections from Science of Mind, Guide for Spiritual Living, and the theme again this month is In Living Color. Don't fit in, fit out. Our job in this lifetime is not to shape ourselves into some ideal we imagine we ought to be, but to find out who we already are and become it. Stephen Pressfield, The War of Art. Automatically, you get rid of the negatives by the implanting of positives. Negatives cannot exist when positives fill the space. When the sunshine of love and confidence fills your whole being, the darkness of the negatives has to disappear. Ernest Holmes, The Basic Ideas of Science of Mind, page 47.4. We do not change the world by denying what is broken, any more than we can fix a toothache by denying the cavity. In many ways, life conditions us to color inside the lines, such that many never discover the truth that they are divine beings. We compete with the Joneses and do our best to get our grass to be as green as the grass we imagine on the other side, which we see as better or even perfect. If God wanted to fit in, why would it bother to incarnate as the diverse types of fruits, vegetables, animals, plants, or people? Why would a God that fits in even bother to incarnate at all? Life is the very definition of diversity. Our unique appearances, ways of communicating, dancing, cooking, and creating should be embraced, nurtured, and celebrated, not denied for the sake of fitting in. Fitting in is an attempt to belong. But we must first belong to ourselves. The creation of the beloved community happens when the sense of belonging we accept for ourselves is shared and spread to such a degree that others begin to feel for themselves the love of belonging to themselves. What if we colored outside the lines so powerfully and passionately that the lines dissolve and the vision of what can be becomes a reality of what is? There's only one Michelangelo, Einstein, Siddhartha, Mother Mary or Jesus, but there are many divine geniuses, Buddhas and Christs, and you are one. Affirmation. Wherever I am, wherever I go, the infinite oneness is, which means I am inseparable from it and I belong. Celebrate infinite diversity. It is not our differences that divide us. It is our inability to recognize, accept, and celebrate those differences. Audre Lorde. I believe the spirit is in the wind and wave and manifests its presence throughout all nature, but most completely through our own minds and in our hearts. It proclaims our livingness and its lovingness. Ernest Holmes, Can We Talk to God? Page 79.2. Many people, even those unfamiliar with Star Trek, are familiar with the Vulcan phrase, live long and prosper. But what about the acronym IDIC? The Vulcan phrase, Kolutshan, translates as infinite diversity in infinite combinations, IDIC. This phrase is a core principle of the Vulcan culture to celebrate the vastness of the universe and all its diverse forms. It's almost laughable that many people criticize the more recent Star Trek shows, calling them too woke. Perhaps these people have never watched the original show or understood the vision of its creator, Gene Roddenberry. If they had, they would have seen what diversity, equity, and inclusion could look like in our lifetime. While the TV show was fictional, the vision was as aspirational as a vision of Centers for Spiritual Living, a world that works for everyone. The vision of this world can only become a realized experience when we start to actualize God, Spirit, the universe, more than we theorize about God. Our vision can only be realized when we honor and celebrate our differences in language, culture, customs, skin colors, spiritual beliefs, ethnicities, gender expressions, physical and cognitive expressions, and more. There is only one God, and it is individualizing itself as all there is. Why would we not honor that? How are you being invited to recognize and actualize IDIC in how you live and relate with the divinity of everyone and everything? Affirmation. I consciously celebrate the infinite as it expresses itself in infinite forms, and the more I celebrate and honor, the more my presence heals any forms of separation. We turn now to the Daily Word published by Unity. Adventurous. I heed the call to explore, I am adventurous. I'm meant for so much more than a small, unexamined life. The world is vast, and its wonders infinite. I answer the call to explore and grow and discover what life has to offer and feel my life expand. If I struggle with the idea of striking out on my own and having new experiences, I remember that God, Spirit, the universe, is everywhere present, and the presence of the divine is within each new person I encounter. This realization comforts and encourages me to seek new vistas and try new things. The world is mine to explore and discover. As I prepare to embark on my adventures, I remember the protecting love of God goes with me wherever I go. I affirm, exploration is fun and discovery is a joy. I am adventurous. Let go, let God. I release limitations and allow divine intuition to guide me. When I take steps in my life, I usually have a goal in mind. Whether my path is spiritual or secular, I take action to achieve the desired outcome. In the midst of my efforts, I embrace the sacred wisdom to pray and move my feet. This adage reminds me that as a divine being, it is within my power to use my spiritual gifts to move myself in the direction of my dreams. I don't always know where my talents will be needed most, and I trust the guidance of the divine within to lead me to the right place at the right time. While I move forward with a general goal in mind, I release the ultimate outcome. It's empowering to know I need not rely upon my human efforts alone. I let go and let God and trust in divine timing and right outcomes. And from Mark Nepo's The Book of Awakening, Living the Life You Want by Being Present to the Life You Have, there are the signs. Pain is often a sign that something has to change. Our hearts and bodies often give us messages we fail to pay attention to. Ironically, we are all so aware of pain, can hardly ignore it, but we rarely hear what it has to say. It is true that we may need to withstand great pain, great heartache, great disappointment and loss in order to unfold into the rest of our lives, but our pain may also be showing us exactly where we need to change. If we view our bodies as bridges that carry us from our inner life to the outer world, then pain often gives us insight as to where the bridge is experiencing the most stress. Pain lets us know where we might crack, where our lives need to be reinforced and rested in order for us to keep bringing our inner and outer lives together. During my struggle with cancer, I experienced a variety of deep and acute pains. I learned how to hold on and let go, learned how to endure, that is, let the pain go through without denying its hurt. But the most crucial thing I learned was to listen to the pain. I was being worn down by my chemo treatments, which were very aggressive. I was trying the best I knew how to live through as many treatments as I could manage. Everyone was coaching me to stick it out. Certainly, I was told by those more afraid than I, you want to swallow as much poison as you can tolerate so the cancer will be stricken from your body completely. I remained committed to this approach. But after 4 months, I lost feeling in my fingers and toes. The chemo was causing nerve damage, and I'd lost my reflexes. I struggled, unsure whether to continue or not. I felt that the cancer was gone, but the chemo was insurance. Endure more if you can. Hold on. Within 24 hours, I was up in the night with the worst stomach attack I have ever experienced. There I was, pacing the living room floor at 3 in the morning, trying to endure the pain, asking God for a sign. The chemo had now ulcerated my esophagus. Another attack gripped me. I doubled over. God, give me a sign. What should I do? I want to live. Another attack. This happened 3 more times when I suddenly realized the pain was the sign, and its message was to stop. It was over. There I stood, hunched over with my windpipe bleeding and numbness in my hands and feet, and God was saying, these are the signs. Do you want more? I can give you more. The next day I told my sweet doctor that I would not take that needle to my arm again, and it was over. Breathe slowly and meditate on a pain that has been troubling you. It might be physical or emotional or even mental. Rather than toughening and resisting the onset of the pain, try to let it move through you. Notice where the pain is most acute. Notice where you first feel it and where you last feel it as it subsides. What is the pain telling you about the piece of your body or heart or mind that is moving through? What might you change in how you move, feel, or think that will strengthen this part of you that is hurting? We return to Science of Mind for Reverend Jane Beach's monthly column, Free to Be. Grab hold of the magic of faith. Have you ever been so upset that you couldn't find the words to pray? Me too. Some of my most profound experiences of prayer happened when I didn't have the wherewithal to utter a single word. Instead, I cried, knowing that all my jumbled feelings were being held up by the one that adored me and knew exactly what I needed. That's prayer. I lean into my personal relationship with the God of my understanding. What do I know is true? I know my loved ones are divinely accepted and loved, whether they know it or not, whether they believe it or not. Next, I think about them in the positive expectation that everything they are doing now will be important in the big picture of their lives. I don't need to understand it. I just need to trust that it's true. Then I get on with living my best life, as the joy in my life sends good energy their way. Faith, the sanity saver, is my rock. I used to hold those I cared about tightly, trying to make sure we were all safe and happy. Then I remembered how much I had grown through my hardest challenges. Shouldn't I give them the same opportunity? How else will they know how capable they really are? I changed my focus from, I have to save them, to, it's their chance to grow. My angst isn't what they needed. It was my prayers. I use my powerful self-will to cultivate a deepening faith instead of wringing my hands with worry. I start by consciously modifying my mood. Taking tiny, determined steps toward optimism, I clean out a drawer, plant a flower, take a brisk walk, or call an upbeat friend. My belief in prayer sends vibrations of hope out into the world. A bounty of peace, joy, and love is available to each of us. Today, my prayer is for all to know it, feel it, and accept it. O infinite Creator, hold us softly in your great love. Remind us that your light connects us to all people and all things, the light alive in each of us. May we remember that we're here on purpose, created to shine the light of love, peace, and joy in our own way. Today, may we know the truth of our being and live from that knowing. Releasing worry, I grab hold of faith and let it work its magic in my life. And from the same issue, we turn to an article by Ryan Alexander. We are here. We cannot wait. When asked to write this article, I must admit, I felt both excited and a little nervous. There's always a vulnerability in putting your experiences and thoughts into words for the world to see, but I knew it was necessary, not only to share my own journey, but to shed light on the very real experiences of so many others. I also felt it was necessary as one who seeks to empower others to not only live their most authentic lives, but to also create spaces for others to do the same. I hope that you can lean into curiosity and hear the following words, not only as a call to action, but also as a true opportunity to be principal in action. If my words seem passionate and fraught with urgency, then I will have succeeded. I'm a transgender, non-binary, ordained minister in our movement. Like me, countless transgender, non-binary, and gender-expansive individuals face significant struggles, including systemic discrimination, lack of legal protection, social rejection, and violence. In many places, we are denied basic rights, health care, employment, safe housing, simply because of our gender and gender expression. The rise of anti-trans legislation and harmful rhetoric only deepens these challenges, creating an environment where many of us feel unsafe, unseen, or unworthy. Our struggle is not just for survival, but for recognition, respect, and the right to exist fully and authentically. We are your neighbors, your co-workers, your friends, your family, and members of your spiritual communities. We are here. We cannot wait. We cannot wait for you to feel unafraid enough, comfortable enough, or knowledgeable enough to take a stand. We cannot wait until you think you are spiritual enough, grounded enough, or organized enough to take action. The time is now. In all the messiness, the uncertainty, and the wondering what to do next, it is time to act in alignment with our principles. Our philosophy was made for this pivotal moment. How we respond will determine not only the future of our movement, but the future of our collective experience. We are here. We cannot wait. This moment demands that we, as an organization and a movement, actively engage in the work of social justice, ensuring that our philosophy is not just theoretical, but lived. If we truly believe in the principles of love, unity, and justice, then it is time for us as an organization and movement, and for every spiritual community within it, to become fearless, unapologetic, passionate advocates for transgender, non-binary, and gender-expansive rights. This includes education and awareness, offering teachings on gender diversity within spiritual education programs, ensuring that practitioners, ministers, and members understand and affirm transgender, non-binary, and gender-expansive individuals. Policy and protection. Creating clear policies that ensure transgender, non-binary, and gender-expansive people are fully included and protected in CSL spaces, including gender-neutral facilities, and recognition of chosen names and pronouns. Public advocacy. Speaking out against anti-trans policies and laws, standing in solidarity with movements that protect transgender, non-binary, and gender-expansive lives. Remembering that standing for something requires recognition of what is actively working against what we're trying to actualize. This recognition paves the way for actions that support and uphold the principles we affirm. Leadership representation. Ensuring transgender, non-binary, and gender-expansive perspectives are present in leadership roles, shaping the future of our spiritual movement. At its core, Science of Mind is a philosophy of transformation rooted in the understanding that all life is interconnected and that we have the power to create a world that reflects the highest truth of love, justice, and unity. It teaches that we're not bound by past limitations, that we have the power to create a new reality, and that justice is an expression of divine balance. This means social justice is not and cannot be separate from our spiritual practice. It is our spiritual practice. A world that works for everyone does not tolerate transphobia, exclusion, or erasure. It actively works to dismantle these barriers. Science of Mind is not just a philosophy of individual self-actualization. It is a blueprint for a world transformed. We as a movement are here. We cannot wait. One of the foundational principles of Science of Mind is the concept of oneness. We affirm that there is only one life, one presence, one source expressing through all beings. If we truly believe this, then we must acknowledge that when injustice exists for one group, that injustice affects the whole. There can be no true spiritual liberation while any member of our human family remains marginalized, oppressed, or erased. CSL's global vision statement reads, "We see a world in which every person lives in alignment with their highest spiritual principle, emphasizing unity with God and connection with each other, a world in which individually and collectively we are called to a higher state of consciousness and action." If we are truly committed to this vision, then it must include transgender, non-binary, and gender-expansive individuals as full and equal participants, not only in our spiritual communities, but in our collective human experience. A higher state of consciousness and action calls us to do more than merely tolerate diversity. It demands that we affirm, support, and uplift all expressions of gender as sacred and divine. For transgender, non-binary, and gender-expansive individuals, the harm caused by exclusion, discrimination, and systemic violence is real. Science of Mind calls us to be active participants in healing these wounds, not through passive acceptance, but through conscious action. Love without justice is incomplete. To live in alignment with our spiritual principles means to stand up for those whose dignity and humanity are denied. We are here. We cannot wait. Science of Mind teaches that our thoughts create our reality, both individually and collectively. While this truth has often been applied to personal prosperity, health, and relationships, it must also be applied to societal transformation. If we recognize that systems of oppression are built on collective beliefs in separation, fear, and hierarchy, then we must also recognize our role in shifting those beliefs toward equity, inclusion, and liberation. CSL's global vision also affirms, we see a world in which we live and grow as one global family that respects and honors the interconnectedness of all life. Respecting and honoring interconnectedness means actively dismantling structures that cause harm. Transgender, non-binary, and gender-expansive people are part of this global family, and it is time for us as an organization and a philosophy to live out this vision by ensuring that their lives are valued, protected, and celebrated. We're not merely here to change our own lives. We are here to uplift the life of every single person on this planet. This means dismantling outdated and harmful beliefs about gender, identity, and worthiness. Speaking truth to power, knowing that spiritual law responds to our declarations of justice. Holding a higher vision of a world where all people are safe, seen, and celebrated. We are here. We cannot wait. CSL's global vision further proclaims, we envision a world where personal responsibility joins with social conscience in every area of the political, corporate, academic, and social sectors, providing sustainable structures to further the emerging global consciousness. Personal responsibility and social conscience demand that we as a spiritual movement take clear action to support the rights of transgender, non-binary, and gender-expansive individuals as manifestations of the One. This means standing against anti-trans legislation, ensuring that our spiritual communities are safe and affirming, and uplifting transgender, non-binary, and gender-expansive perspectives within our leadership. It is not enough to believe in justice. We must embody it. Liberation is a spiritual principle. New Thought historically focused on personal liberation, on the ability to free ourselves from limiting beliefs and step into a greater experience of life. However, the highest expression of liberation is not just personal, it is communal. CSL's global vision challenges us to imagine and create a world that works for all. A world that works for all is one where no one's identity is questioned, where all bodies are honored, and where every person is free to express the divine truth of who they are. A world that works for everyone does not tolerate transphobia, exclusion, or erasure. It actively works to dismantle these barriers. This means our organization and movement must not only welcome transgender, non-binary, and gender-expansive individuals, but must actively create spaces where they're affirmed, uplifted, and celebrated. It means integrating gender diversity into our spiritual education, ensuring representation in leadership, and boldly advocating for policies that protect the lives of transgender, non-binary, and gender-expansive people. Science of Mind is not just a philosophy of individual self-actualization. It is a blueprint for a world transformed, and that transformation must include, embrace, and advocate for transgender, non-binary, and gender-expansive people. We are here. We cannot wait. If we truly commit to our global vision, we must move beyond words and into action. A vision offers a glimpse of what is possible, but without action, it remains just that, an idea rather than a reality. It is through action that we bring this vision to life. The global vision is not just an aspiration. It is a call to social justice. Without meaningful engagement, it is just words. To create a world that works for all, we must embody our principles with boldness, compassion, and an unwavering dedication to justice. Our global vision is more than a statement. It is a commitment. It becomes real only when we take a values-based stand, both individually and collectively. It is not just about affirming the world we wish to see. It also is about actively building that world for ourselves and for the future of our organization, our movement, and our world. If we as an organization and a philosophy are to remain relevant and transformative, we must actively participate in the work of social justice. This is not about politics. It is about spiritual integrity. It is about ensuring that the principles we teach are reflected in the communities we create. Our philosophy calls us to a higher standard, to be the living embodiment of love, justice, and truth. The time to act is now. We are here. We cannot wait. From the same issue, we turn to Reverend Dr. Jesse Jennings' questions and answers. Spirit, causation working through us. Question: Is personal consciousness a manifestation of spirit, and as such, an effect? Or is it spirit as causation working through me? One can make the case that just as every cause generates effects, every effect becomes a subsequent cause of further effects. In this scenario, there's no demarcation of where cause ends and effect begins, or vice versa. We often refer to spirit as first cause or the uncaused to signify its transcendence. The whole cause-effect rollout is often pictured as a circle, and alchemically as the Ouroboros, a serpent consuming its own tail, symbolic of the cycle of life into death and death into rebirth. Personal consciousness remains a mystery, as does our latitude of choice. How free are we, really, from the compulsions of prior experience that bear down on the present moment and its decisions? The Science of Mind teaching on this subject asks us to take a few things for granted, as all faith systems require of us. One is that spirit or God or the thing itself is real. Further, it is infinite. Still further, being infinite, it is changeless, yet it envelops within itself all change and every possibility. Each manifestation of material form is an impulse in consciousness, a thought or pattern of thought outpictured, as Ernest Holmes would say. Each sentient being is essentially the experience that spirit is having of itself in this world at this time by means of that being. Thus, yes, spirit as causation is working through us, and personal consciousness is the field in which we're capable of not only recognizing this, but efficiently collaborating with the process. Again, where the universe as a whole leaves off, and we as particular expressions of it begin, is anybody's guess. The safest bet, though, is that the causal realm just never leaves off. We carry infinity and eternity within us, directed into specific form as needed. Mind moves and form follows. We are made of love, but once we find it within ourselves, we must do something with it. We pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you're currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. You can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Well, last week we came to the end of The Great Awakening, Our Prophecy, Transformation, and the Attainment of Embodied Enlightenment by Mike Dooley in conversation with six renowned channels. And we had come to the epilogue, which I will share with us now. In June 2021, a year before hosting the online course that would become the genesis of this book, with my interest in self-realization and embodied enlightenment soaring, I reached out to Tracy Farquhar, my friend and co-author of Channeled Messages from Deep Space, Wisdom for a Changing World. I invited Frank, a collective she channels from a planet they call Brohushka, to shed some light on the nature of self-realization and to speak on whether or not it's the ultimate goal of our human existence. While the wisdom of their tempered reply was not fully evident to me at the time, as I've grown, so has my deep appreciation for it. Profound, on point, even cautionary, it synchronistically makes the perfect epilogue for and confirmation of the preceding pages with intriguing insights into the lives of known masters who've graced the face of Earth. Enlightenment versus transcendence. In order to fully understand any concept such as enlightenment, one must detach from the preconceived notions and theories surrounding it, since those notions and theories are constructs of the human mind, which, while fully realized as miraculous, have limitations in their ability to understand the workings of consciousness and spirit. Even now, you're working within the limitations of the human mind, except when you cease trying intellectually to understand and begin spiritually to embrace the nature of yourself as an unlimited being. Your nature is an energetic one, and it is presently expressing itself as a physical form. That physical form creates limitations, some of which may be overcome, and some which cannot, for that is the intention of incarnating in the physical state. Enlightenment is a transcendent state, and while many humans and other beings have reached an advanced state of energetic frequency congruent with your limited ideas of enlightenment, to be fully transcended from their experience is not the goal of the human or any physical experience. If it were, what would be the point except to test the limitations of a lesser physical experience? Would that not negate the sacredness of that experience? The goal or intention of a physical being is to provide the soul with a unique perspective that is unavailable any other way, and through that experience, to fulfill the soul's curiosity and desire to expand its consciousness continually without having an end point of complete transcendence. Nevertheless, aspiring to live in a state which brings light, which emanates light, which encourages light, is inherent in all consciousness, both to minimize suffering and to experience greater joy. That light contains truth, compassion, acceptance, and high states of both spiritual and physical awareness, for you are both. And while some have dedicated their lives to living with greater illumination, their experience will simply become one of many in the energetic intelligence of their soul, no more and no less important than any other. The masters who walked your earth were human, in every way, and while they imparted an elevated sense of wisdom and truth, they did not transcend the human experience. Their intention was to assist and support those who struggle and suffer, and to impart the truth of love as a balm for the wounded and the unloved. It was to inspire and create a flow of loving energy. To us, that is the highest degree of enlightenment that a human or any other form of incarnated physical being can experience. We will not deign to understand all there is to understand about the reasons and object of the soul's decision to incarnate physically, but as we have become a bit more educated in the realm of consciousness, we see the sacredness of every level of energetic frequency and every form of physical incarnation and every step upon the path that each individual takes as it walks in that physical form. It is all sacred, it is all transcendent, and it is all a form of enlightenment. We also believe that the more you strive for something, the more it slips through your fingers, as that striving interrupts the flow of your frequency and distracts you from the present moment. Cease striving, and you will achieve. Cease wanting to understand, and you will allow that understanding to flow through you. Cease wanting to be more aware, and that awareness will blossom. Be that light that you seek, and within that light, you will have the highest experience of what this lifetime has to offer you. Frank, channeled by Tracy Farquhar. And you can find her at www.tracyfarquhar.com. Well, I did go ahead and order that book for us, Channeled Messages from Deep Space, Wisdom for a Changing World. I have another one that we shared that was from Tracy Farquhar and Mike, and that was from 2017. This one is from 2021, and it sounded just very pertinent to us on our planet, our country, our world at this time. So we will be able to start sharing that book on next week's program. We turn now to the May-June 2025 issue of Spirituality and Health, a Unity publication, and an article by Carol Orsborn, Ph.D., Letting Life Flow, Five Contemplative Lessons from the Riverbank. Transitioning from the peak of middle age to the uncharted waters of retirement, my husband and I realized we had the perfect opportunity to deepen our spiritual practice by moving anywhere we wanted. We chose to move thousands of miles from the demands of our busy West Coast life to a stone cottage on the banks of the Cumberland, a meandering river in the heart of Tennessee. What better mentor could we ask for to teach us about letting life flow? Even as the river beckoned to me through frosty windows, it took several seasons to settle into the contemplative lifestyle I'd imagined for myself. And when I did, it did not look anything like what I'd pictured. At last, answering the call, I made a vow to sit by the river every day for the entire summer, whatever my mood or inclination. To my undying gratitude, eventually the old and patient river began to share its secrets with me. What I learned was both simple and profound. five lessons that showed me the way to flow through the course of my life, transforming aging into a spiritual experience. Lesson 1. Limitation creates depth. When I was younger, I imagined myself in the distant future, sitting cross-legged on the banks of a gently flowing river. What I did not anticipate was having to get my husband Dan's help dragging the heaviest garden chair, the one with the ergonomic back, down a precipitous set of stone stairs to the water's edge. Rather than experiencing transcendence, I quickly realized that the effortless freedom I'd imagined earlier was to be bound by the limitations imposed by age. In addition to facing up to tangible evidence of physical diminishment, I was forced to confront other losses and imposed limits associated with aging. The nest that had emptied, familiar roles left behind, regrets over things left undone, fear of the future, and more. How was I ever to learn about flowing through this daunting patch of life when all I could see of the river through my downcast eyes was the rocky edge of the riverbank at my feet? I did not expect an answer, and if one were to come, surely it would echo forth from the river itself and not from the dirt beneath my orthopedic shoes. But I was wrong on both counts. Yes, the riverbank whispered, it is true that you are bound by limitations, but so too is the river. In fact, the banks are not only what make a river possible, but also what create the very flow you are seeking to experience. Look up and see what is before you. What you call limitations are what give the water direction and energy. It is limitation that creates depth. This, then, was lesson 1. We are entitled to feel all our emotions, including grieving our losses. But understand this, limitation is not the antithesis of flow, but the very means of deepening the channel through which spirit flows. Lesson 2. You can't make flow happen. I found permission to embrace the limitations accompanying my transition to a new life stage liberating, and I couldn't wait for my next lesson. At the crack of dawn, I ran to the riverbank, eager for the day's gift. What teachings would the river show me today? But when I took my seat, I was dismayed by what met my eyes. Instead of the energy and movement I expected, I was blinded by the unfiltered sun reflecting off the river's surprisingly stagnant surface. Apparently, the river was unconcerned about meeting my expectations. Some days it flowed dynamically, while other days, I now realized, its current would appear to stall to a pace listless and unwelcoming, even hostile. Surely there was still a lesson in here for me, just not the one I was hoping for. It took nearly more humility than I could muster to realize that flow is not about demanding answers, peace, or meaning. It's not something you get or make, but something you allow. I had thought this was something I already knew, having long ago figured out that I could never be smart enough or good enough, exercise enough, or take just the right mix of supplements to get everything to turn out the way I expected. Apparently, I now had to add spiritual enough to that list. I once feared embracing powerlessness as crossing into a wasteland. What a surprise to find myself not in forced exile, but more alive than ever. When I dared look up again, the river, so inhospitable just moments ago, was suddenly undulating with unexpected intimacy. Exactly as I am, I had been let back in. Lesson 3. The present moment is ageless. When we finally give up driving ourselves through life, our bodies, minds, and spirits organically relax into the slower rhythms aging offers us. I was learning to embrace my limitations rather than resist them, and to drop my agendas. Only then could I even begin to experience the gentle breeze caressing my face, or smell the musky fragrance of a fallen tree majestically floating by on the current. My brain had quieted down, and having finally arrived in the present moment, I was neither young nor old, limited nor boundless. Rather, I found myself merged with the ripples and eddies, needing to do nothing more than feel. Now is ageless and timeless, the history of my life and ruminations about the future replaced with simply being. A silverfish leapt at my feet. Do you call this joy? I asked the river. Yes, joy, the river replied. Only joy. Lesson 4. Forgive reality for what it can't help being. I prefer the river on the magical days when each ripple is topped by a diamond and the ducks bow their heads. The present moment is ageless, But any celebration of my spiritual progress proved to be premature. In older age, when it comes to our spiritual growth, the stakes are constantly being raised and the challenges cut closer to the bone. We suffer unexpected illnesses. People we love die. Without the protective cover of midlife's roles and productivity, dormant fears are more easily triggered. There are times when it becomes all too easy to ruminate on our regrets in the name of introspection. And on those days, if we allow ourselves to define ourselves by the unfinished business of the past and anxiety about the future, we do not flow. We struggle. But by now, I had a spiritual practice in place, even on those stormy days when the river turned angry and murky green. Borrowing Dan's oversized slicker, I took my seat by the river, as had become my habit. I did not expect nor want to merge with the white-capped waves erupting erratically before me. But as I sat blinking away the raindrops, I saw that beneath the churn, the river was still flowing. Regardless of how the wind ravaged the surface, the river would not be stopped. It persisted. When the water came upon a rock, it did not argue. It flowed around or over. If the obstacle was too high, the water piled up upon itself until it could move the obstacle aside or find another way. Until that rainy day, I assumed the river preferred serenity over roiling, a smooth surface to choppy bits. But in truth, what the river does so well is accommodate. It accommodates the gentle breeze and the cutting bow of the ship equally. It does not judge. It allows. Why waste precious time struggling with reality? Life is unfair? So what? Forgive reality and get on with it. Lesson 5. Flow is unconditional. At summer's end, I headed to the river for my last day of formal practice. Some days the mist that hovered over the river like angels turned the river magical. Other days the surface seemed stagnant and listless. By now I knew enough not to bring an agenda to the riverbank, but just sit. And so it was I had left behind any expectations for a grand finale, and found comfort in knowing that the secrets the river had to share were no longer special occasions, but part of the flow of my life. But even so, as it turned out, the river had one last lesson for me. "Today I have nothing profound for you," the river told me, "only the offer of relief that however you are feeling, hopeless, despairing, angry, you are welcome to sit at my side. I see you just as you are, as you now see me as I am. I will not judge you. I will only love you." All those years I'd imagined living contemplatively on the bank of the river, I had not once imagined myself in orthopedic shoes, seated in an ergonomic garden chair. I thought that the me who would finally master flowing through life would be better than my ordinary self, profoundly transformed. But in the end, the river showed me that what I was seeking all along had been simply to tell the truth about who I am at this stage of my life, knowing that whatever is going on with me, I am beloved, unconditionally. And so on the first morning of fall, having fulfilled my vow, I floated awake. Nothing grand, just lying in bed wondering how the river looked this morning. The big garden chair with the ergonomic back would need to be moved back up the steep stone steps to storage before the weather changed. I'd have to ask Dan for his help. The nest was still empty, the future uncharted, and I noted a new ache in my right hip. Then, heart overflowing with gratitude, I got on with it. And from the same issue, we turn to an article by Catherine Ann Lombard, "Sacred Journeys, the Bell That Peals for Peace." When a woman journeyed to Assisi only to find its iconic peace bell had been silenced, she made it her mission to hear it ring again. At one point a few years ago, I felt as if there were a hole in my heart. The news seemed to be only of war, and our political leaders seemed ready to confront conflict with military madness. Longing for peace, I decided to go to Assisi, a short trip from my home in Italy, to ring the peace bell. I felt called to perform this symbolic act of hope. Somebody, I thought, has to go and ring that peace bell. So on a fall day, I drove along a quiet, hilly back road full of curves and beautiful views of the Apennine Mountains. The fields were dotted with olive groves and vineyards, interlaced with woodlands and bed and breakfast inns, and the autumn light glowed soft and warm, unlike the torrid summer sun that pricks one's skin. Assisi, also known as the City of Peace, is the birthplace of St. Francis. The town feels as if it is piled up upon itself, stone upon stone, shining like rose quartz and nestled into the hillside above the Valley of Spoleto. As I approached the city that day, I first caught sight of the Rocca Maggiore, a fortress dating to 1174. Soon afterward, the spectacular 13th-century Basilica of San Francesco came into view. The Peace Bell is outside the old walls of the city, not far from the basilica. It is supported by four granite columns, each representing a different religion: Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and Buddhism. Designed by German artist Gerhard Kadlitz, the bell is named Regina Pacis, Queen of Peace, and it is meant to unite the four religions to announce peace with one voice. The Peace Bell's official song is Numquam Renascantur Vis Bellum Terror, Never Again Violence, War, Terror. This declaration is inscribed on the lower edge of the bell, which was dedicated in 2007, along with the signatures of four religious leaders: Cardinal Ratzinger, who later became Pope Benedict, His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama, Ali Goma, then Grand Mufti of Egypt, and Yonah Metzger, then Chief Rabbi of Israel. I've always loved visiting the bell, pulling its rope and sending its rich, full sound from the City of Peace into the world. But to my surprise, upon arriving at the bell on this trip, I discovered there was no longer any rope to pull. Even more alarming, there was no longer any clapper to strike the bell. The Peace Bell, held in the heart of Italy and the City of Peace, was silent, unringable, still. Looking up at the empty bell, I felt utterly despondent. This hollow peace bell felt so symbolic of our times. I became determined to find out why the peace bell had fallen silent. A search for the clapper. Since the peace bell used to be inside the Bosco di San Francesco, the forest of St. Francis, I first went to its office. A woman explained that the peace bell was under the jurisdiction of the Basilica of St. Francesco. If you find out why it can't be rung, please come back and tell me, she said. Next, I went to the information office at the basilica, where a young woman said she didn't know anything about a peace bell. As I insisted that there was one and that I knew where it was, even if she didn't, and that it was not ringable, and I wanted to know why, she kept making faces as if to say, "Why is this crazy old American woman bothering me with questions about this stupid non-existent peace bell?" Finally, she tossed her business card for the basilica at me and told me to write and ask them. Finally, I entered the basilica to ask the friar, who sits for hours in a little cabin near the entrance. He is there for pilgrims who have questions or wish for prayers. The friar's bulk seemed to fill the little booth. He was absorbed talking to someone on his telefonino. Finally, he hung up and looked at me. I asked about the peace bell, and he told me that if I wanted peace, I should go pray for it. He then swung his hand toward the nearby chapel as if to sweep me away into the nearest pew. "But I already pray every day for peace," I said. "I am feeling very sad. I came all the way here to ring the peace bell." "Well then," he said, "go find a stick. You can hit the bell with a stick." He then suddenly jumped into action and called for the nearby guard. "Giuseppe, do we have an umbrella?" "Not a good one, mind you." The guard then ran into a nearby corner room and came out with a small, foldable umbrella. I laughed, relieved to let go of some of my frustration. "No, no," I said, "that's too small. That will never reach." "Find something long," the friar commanded. Giuseppe ran back and emerged with a long plastic tube. "Oh, that will work," I said, taking the tubing. "Thank you so much." And off I went. As I climbed the stairs back toward the peace bell, I started to cry. Why was it so hard to ring this bell right at the moment when the world seemed to need peace more than ever? Upon arriving to the bell, I bowed low, reached up with the plastic tube, and hit the bell three times. As it rung, people started to gather. When the bell stopped, after the third time, I bowed once more and left the tubing nearby for the next bell ringer to use. The power of prayer and action. The first thing I did upon returning home was to write to the Basilica of San Francesco to ask what had happened to the peace bell. They told me it had probably been moved from the front of the church and that maybe in the future they would move it back. "We're glad you managed to ring it," they wrote, "but peace is something we must build in our heart and share with our neighbors." This was a very nice response, but first of all, the bell was never in front of the church. The bell is impossible to move. Four massive granite columns hold the heavy brass bell aloft. Secondly, peace is in my heart. That's why I went to the City of Peace to ring the bell. Ringing the bell is a symbolic way for me to share peace with my neighbors and with the world. After all, St. Francis's life was full of symbolic acts. Of course, he prayed for peace, but in 1219 he also traveled to Egypt and met the Sultan Malik al-Kamil in an attempt to put an end to the Fifth Crusade. He preached to the birds. He built a church. He kissed lepers, ulcerous sores. Throughout his lifetime, the poor man of Assisi lived a symbolic life. While renouncing his father and patrimony, Francis stripped himself naked in front of the Bishop of Assisi. He arranged the first live nativity scene to celebrate Christmas. He and his followers wore coarse wooden tunics and a rope belt with 3 to 5 knots, each knot representing a specific vow. Finally, I had the insight to contact Cadletz, the artist who created the bell. He was surprised and deeply troubled to hear that the peace bell in Assisi had fallen silent, especially because he was just completing another work titled Wo ist der Frieden? Where is the peace? Cadletz's new bell was an exact replica of the peace bell in Assisi. However, he had deliberately silenced his new bell. This bell was tightly wound with barbed wire from the Gannaker concentration camp in Germany. The bell itself precariously hung from a 10,000-year-old bog oak that was partially charred, and the clapper was tightly tied with rope so the bell could not be rung. Symbolically, a clapper represents power and the bell wisdom. When separated, they both become out of balance and less effective. Power without wisdom can be dominating, reckless, and even abusive. Wisdom without power can be anemic and nothing more than self-affirming. After many emails, several inquiries, and months of waiting, Cadletz finally received word from the Franciscan friars in Assisi that they found the peace bell clapper, which had been discarded nearby in the woods. They promised to restore the clapper, and we both waited a few more months for the repair to be made. Once the peace bell was complete again, Cadletz planned to drive to Assisi, his car full of Bavarian beer for the Franciscan friars, to celebrate the bell's renewal. Perhaps the best part of this story is that exactly 1 year after my first inquiries, I had the privilege to meet the peace bell artist himself and ring the bell alongside him. Upon meeting for the first time, we exchanged a big hug. United in our love for the peace bell and our mutual campaign to hear it ring again, we both rejoiced in pulling the cord to have the clapper once more strike the bell. Its sweet song rang over the town and floated out into the world. Peace, the kind that St. Francis demonstrated with both prayer and action, could finally be heard again. And from the same issue, Sarah A. Bowen's monthly column, Creaturely Reflections, Talking to Animals. If I were asked to sing in Hippopotamus, reflects Dr. Doolittle, I'd say Wynonymous, and I would, in the snappy feature song from the 1967 film of the same name, Doolittle imagines communicating with 23 distinct species, even considering the potential benefits of speaking slang to an orangutan. This beloved fictional veterinarian captured the imagination of an entire generation, influencing both popular culture and scientific discourse regarding animal communication. Today, methods abound, including ancient shamanic practices and more modern approaches such as reading body language, using programmable buttons, and teaching American Sign Language, all reflecting our desire for interspecies dialogue. Talking with animals did not begin with Doolittle, though. There's a long history within my birth tradition of Christianity regarding saints who spoke to animals, the best known as St. Francis of Assisi, often shown preaching to a flock of birds with a companion wolf at his side. In Ireland, a story is told of St. Kevin of Glendalough, who extended his hand out of a window while praying. A blackbird landed in his palm, built her nest, and laid eggs. Kevin remained still until the fledglings hatched and flew away. Nearby in England, St. Cuthbert of Lindisfarne sang psalms by the sea. Animals gathered to listen, otters warming Cuthbert's feet with their breath and fur. In Russia, St. Seraphim of Sarov, a forest dweller, formed deep connections with bears and other wildlife through prayer and meditation. My favorite anecdote features St. Anthony of Padua, whose feast day is celebrated every June. According to legend, he traveled to Rimini, Italy, to preach, but faced resistance from the townspeople, who seemed indifferent to his message. Frustrated by their lack of faith, Anthony turned to the nearby Adriatic Sea. Standing by the water's edge, he began preaching to sea creatures. A large shoal of fish appeared, rising above the water's surface to listen. The 14th-century book, The Little Flowers of St. Francis, suggests Anthony's sermon included these words: God, your bountiful and kind creator, when he made you, ordered you to increase and multiply, and gave you his blessing. In the universal deluge, all other creatures perished. You alone did God preserve from all harm. It said the townspeople were astounded by the fish's attentiveness, leading to a renewed interest in Anthony's teachings. While the retelling of the story is usually meant to inspire Christians to strengthen their faith, I believe that people of any spiritual tradition can glean a useful message, especially those concerned about the welfare of animals or biodiversity loss. Are you ever met with resistance or indifference to your concern about human impacts on other species and habitats? I know that experience well. When I'm frustrated, I confess that I sometimes feel like talking slang to an orangutan, hoping they'll understand. In these moments, I draw inspiration from St. Anthony's example. I step outside and look up into the trees, watching the communicative flicking of squirrel tails and listening to the vocalizations of the multi-species flock around me. I know just enough about their specific languages to understand the distance at which they prefer me to sit, so as not to disturb their comings and goings. Settling in, I begin to speak to any creature choosing to listen. You are blessed with a life I care deeply about. Do you know I am trying to help protect you from harm? Is there anything else I can do? What do you need from me? And then, ceasing to talk, I listen. Well, we come now to the end of our program. As always, I ask if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact the station and ask them to call me or email me so I can respond to them on air. As always, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and I look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher Program.